The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Laird Hunt. His new novel is The Evening Road. Hello, Laird.
Hi there.
Are you in Colorado?
I am. I'm in snowy Colorado. We're covered up in the white stuff right now.
I'm jealous. Laird, this new book, The Evening Road, I understand that you kind of got the original idea for this by hearing a story on National Public Radio.
That's right. It was in August 2010. I had the radio on, and a program came on called Strange Fruit: Anniversary of a Lynching. And I was doing other things, and it was only gradually that it really started to catch my attention when I realized this was a program about the infamous lynching in Marion, Indiana, of two young African-American men. And it set all sorts of bells to ringing in my mind because the family farm where I did a lot of my growing up is just about an hour away from Marion. And I had never heard any mention of this event, and it made me wonder why.
And I remember seeing photos, at least one photo of this horrific event, and you can see all these people smiling at the camera, laughing. It's a very festive atmosphere. And then in the background, you can see these poor men. It's the most horrifying thing. You know which photo I'm talking about?
Absolutely. That's the famous one. Infamous is exactly the right word for it. And that circulated nationally, actually. And it was that photograph that a poet in New York named Abel Mirapol saw and then felt moved to write first a poem and then set it to music, which became the song Strange Fruit that Billie Holiday made famous. And so that's another way that the dark legacy of that event has carried forward into the future.
Before you heard that story on NPR, you'd never heard anything about that?
You know, I had seen it here and there, of course, as one of the sort of the dark backdrop of American history or certain aspects thereof, but I hadn't really connected it to the extreme proximity to where my family was in Indiana. And again, so it was hearing that story, which was really wonderfully done and overseen by a scholar who has written terrifically informative book about the event called A Lynching in the Heartland, a scholar named James Madison. All of the things started to fall into place in terms of my sense of the impact of it in a larger cultural sense, but also in a personal sense.
And they never talked about it when you were in Indiana on the farm as a youth. They never mentioned it.
You know, I went to school for 5 years, junior high school and then high school, and it never came up. Hmm. And it wasn't mentioned. I lived with my grandmother, and she never brought it up. And, you know, perhaps that's simply for lack of a reason for it to have come up, but it seems like a pretty big thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think that there was any, again, no conscious effort to say we're not going to speak about this, but I just wondered why I'd never heard of it. Or heard about it in any directed way, or why there wasn't a segment on it in my social studies class at Clinton Central High School, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Laird Hunt joins us. His new novel is The Evening Road. In your novel, the town of Marion that inspired the story, the new town where a lynching is going to take place is called Marvel. How did you decide to set this up the way you did, to structure it the way you did, and tell us how you do it?
Sure. I realized pretty early on that I wasn't going to be retelling the exact story of those events that night. My mind turns and twists into fiction at every possible occasion. But of course, it was going to be grounded in those events. So I wanted to make it clear to readers what I was referring to, and yet also allow for other imaginative possibilities that could shed different kinds of light onto that subject matter. And I've already mentioned that scholars have discussed this and done it very well. And I would mention in that context that one of the young men who was supposed to be lynched that night, a 16-year-old boy whose name was James Cameron, escaped. He wasn't lynched. He went on to write an extraordinary book called A Time of Terror, which I recommend to everyone. So just to say that there are a lot of important writings on this out there, and that I was going to handle it fictionally. And so I realized that the town couldn't be Marion, and I actually changed the names of surrounding towns as well, and set it in a fictional town, fictional surroundings, but also at the same time working very hard to make it feel to readers as if they were in rural Indiana on a hot summer night in 1930. So it's a push-pull between fact and fiction. And once I had those the clear fictional name for the town and for the surrounding towns, I felt my imagination could take useful flight, always remembering where I was taking off from. So I never went too far away from it, but it allowed me to do things that perhaps I wouldn't have done if I'd constantly been looking back to the exact facts of that particular night.
You give us two primary vantage points to look at these intertwined accounts, and they're the vantage points of two women, one named Audie Lee Henshaw and the other named Calla Destry. How did you get inside their heads? How did you get these voices?
Well, so this often happens to me or with me when I'm writing these books about the past. For quite a little while, the entirety of The Evening Road was the first narrative, which is Audie Lee Henshaw's story. And that is a direct leap off, again, from that NPR show, Strange Fruit. One of the very interesting things about that show is that certain people who had been at Marion that night, including James Cameron, were interviewed. And one of them was a woman who was into her later years when she was interviewed about this, who had gone along to the lynching with, it's not quite clear if it was a friend or an employer or a casual acquaintance, but they jumped into a car and went over to the lynching. And she says something. There are a couple of quotes from her, and one of the things she said towards the end of the story was, "After it happened, I wished 1,000 times I hadn't been so inquisitive." And as she says this, she gives a little nervous laugh, as you might imagine. And it was that formulation and the way she said it that really set my mind to working around this person who had done this thing, who had attended this event, and was feeling uneasy about it when asked about it years later. There's a kind of ambiguity at the heart of it. And that's what I wanted to explore. And so I wrote this story about someone who goes to the event, and some 10,000 people apparently were in actual Marion that night. So many people poured in, and I wanted to ride along, so to speak, with someone who was doing it and tried to figure out why and how and what the circumstances were. And so it was Audie Lee's story for quite a while, and then I realized that what was missing, and it felt like something was missing, was another aspect of the story, another angle, another facet. I think American history is far too complex to have simply one take on it, or that's often the case. And out of that urge to think about things a little bit differently, this other character, Calla Destry, emerged, and she's someone who is desperate to get out of town, and yet is finding it harder than she might have thought initially to leave. There's a kind of molasses of circumstance, personal as well as public, that is holding her back and making it hard for her to move forward.
The book is The Evening Road. Laird Hunt joins us, and this really is a road novel. As I started reading it, I had this terrible sense of dread that you were going to take me to this lynching fairly quickly, and that a lot of it would be spent at the lynching. And I was pleased to find out that this wasn't the case. It really is a road novel. We follow these women as they travel, and Audie's journey is quite complicated, and there are a lot of detours, and I think it's fascinating the way that you structured this. And we're trying to figure out, as we're into the second side of it, the account of Calla, who is who, which people are popping up again that were in the other side of the story.
You know, it was really interesting to me, especially as Calla's story started to develop, to see how it kept moving towards Audie's journey, which is in the opposite direction. So it's one of those things of they're seeming opposites, and yet there's so much entanglement along the way. And characters who we have met in the first part of the story do indeed recur, and we see them in a very different light in some cases in that second part of the story. And, you know, back to the question of the presence of the actual lynching in the book, I wanted it to be a sort of vortex around which these other stories are swirling. I'm always interested in looking at those stories, perhaps, that have been a little bit overlooked, that haven't been seen, perhaps not as considered as they should have been. It's something that I've been exploring over the course of the last couple of books. And so it made a lot of sense that, of course, I don't in any way want to minimize that event, but that's not what's going to be front and center throughout the course of this particular story, even though with almost every other thought, it's in their minds in some way or other, and leading them, bending space, bending time, and leading them along these country roads in and creating interesting configurations as they go.
It's difficult, I think, for most of us to imagine participating in such an event or being enthusiastic about doing so. And yet you do a splendid job of making us have to think, what if we were out in this part of rural Indiana in this period and we were getting swept up in the enthusiasm and excitement to go to this town and be a participant in this horror? And we watch as your various characters, and you have a few of them, particularly as we see the first lady, Audie, going to the event, and we try to figure out what is tempering her enthusiasm and whether she really wants to be there. And we put ourselves in her place, and we think, well, would we just play along and just go along because that's what everyone else was doing? It's a real mob mentality kind of thing. And a couple of her fellow travelers are given an opportunity to kind of do the right thing, and I'm not going to say what that was, but there's a situation where they encounter some people and something bad happens, and a couple of them object. But by the time we get further in, suddenly they're going, oh, no, this is great. We're really glad we did that. And it's great to watch that, to see the changes. And I thought, well, this is Indiana. This is a place where we got our Vice President Mike Pence, who was against the immigration ban, and now he's for it. And I kept thinking about modern stuff and holding it up to your story and just saying, oh, the mob rules, and it still rules.
It was one of those occurrences where, as I was writing this novel set in the past, the present kept creeping in with its great insistence. And what was interesting about it was that I didn't feel like I had to, because of living in the world in the 21st century, I didn't feel like I had to do much changing to honor that insistence that kept cropping up about the present. It really was all there, it seemed to me, in this exploration of this night in 1930. And all of these adjustments that people are making on the way to a terrible event or as they're leaving this terrible event, constantly recalibrating, being, as you say, in favor of something and then being against it, or being against it and then in favor of it. And all of those shiftings that occur over in the course of one's normal day, let alone one that's unusually pitched, unusually heightened. And it really did feel absolutely like very little had changed in that granular way about the way human beings can be extraordinary at one moment and then disappointing at another. And all of that, of course, depends on how one is looking at things.
Mm.
But these characters, none of them are entirely good, and maybe a few of them are entirely bad, but most of them, like most of us, are in that middle, that zone, that magma zone, it seems to me, where most of life gets played out. And really, it's very hard to know, indeed, how one will react at any given moment. And even past behavior is not necessarily the best predictor of present or future behavior.
We have all these characters, a number of them somewhat peripheral, and the one in The Evening Road that I think was my favorite character, but he was also probably the most despicable in my view, is this politician. You had a little fun with that character, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really, that was one of the most rewarding re-explorations that I conducted. So I had this character and this version of him in the first part of the book, and then he reoccurs in a major way in the second part of the book, a central way, and reveals himself in some ways to be more appealing, and then in many others to be exactly the opposite of that.
Mm.
And so he has multiple dimensions, and really does seem to embody some of the things we see going on around us right now, this particular character.
Laird Hunt joins us. His new novel is The Evening Road, and I don't want to neglect to mention that there is a third woman, and we do go inside her head a little bit, and what a strange place it is.
She, you know, you mentioned that that particular character was your favorite, the wannabe politician, Sally Gunner, who narrates a brief sort of epilogue section of the book, that she gets the last word, is probably my favorite character, and she is someone who appears in the first part of the novel, and for a little bit of look behind the scenes, she actually had a role in the first draft of Caladestri's section that didn't end up working out, but mm-hmm. She's been someone who's been on my mind for quite a while with this book and this story in different ways, and I love the idea of giving her, who, you know, she's half Native American, or she's part Native American, and it was really important to me to honor the presence on that day of Native Americans. There is a large history of Native Americans around Marion, Indiana, and so to have someone who could speak with that in mind and with that particular history and with all her own human particularities was really, really important to me. She's a bit of a dreamer, a bit of a visionary, and also sort of stubborn and forward-moving at the same time. And I found her quite appealing to think about and write.
Laird, you threw me initially for a little while until I kind of figured out what you're talking about. But when they describe one another, these different racial groups, they all have words with corn in them. Did you make the stuff up, or was that really how they addressed each other or talked about each other?
Yeah, so that is a real particularity of this novel. Instead of the standard racial descriptors of the time or of our time, I went at a certain juncture in favor of these terms. So corn silk refers to white people, corn flour to black people, corn root to Native American people. And this really came out of when I was first working on the novel, soon after having heard the story about the lynching on NPR. And I wrote about 30 or 40 pages using the racial epithets of the time.
Mm.
And, of course, many of them with incredibly negatively charged, and it really felt like it was overpowering the novel. I have that first draft, and the first thing I did to try and mitigate and see my own way forward past this sort of seething presence on the page was to cross out many of the words and insert the word colored, which, of course, is accurate at that time. Mm. But that felt like it was going too far in another direction and felt like a kind of euphemism. And it was then that I realized that I needed to put something there, a kind of placeholder. And I looked in a paint catalog and saw that there were these paint colors. One was cornflower, one was corn silk. And being an Indiana farm boy, having done a lot of detasseling, and also having lived in a house where my grandmother had a painting of cornflowers over the mantelpiece, this immediately seemed like the thing to do. And it was really in my mind that I would then swap them back out once I had seen my way forward into the book. But I realized that it was helping me see farther and farther, to look at the terminology in different ways, but also allowing me to focus on other aspects of the way people were interacting. Not to pretty it up, that's not at all what happens, but it did allow for me to take different directions in the text. And I, when I gave the book, early drafts of the book, to other readers, they had a similar reaction, that they were able to move through it because of this with a different kind of sense of purpose and possibility. And I realized then at a certain juncture that they were just going to stay.
I think it was a great decision. And you threw me a little bit. I got the first two groups fairly quickly. But when you popped in with a couple of corn roots, I'm like, wait a minute. What am I missing here? But then fortunately, you helped me figure that out. I was like, whoa, I don't know who these corn roots are. This is some sort of a hybrid corn.
GMO corn.
Laird Hunt joins us. His book is The Evening Road. I also really enjoyed this vehicle that Khaled Destry drives. Tell us what this is. Was this a real car?
Yeah, so Studebaker made a car that was called the Dictator.
Oh, okay.
In the late 20s and early 30s, I think. And just a glorious, gorgeous, large, American-made, Indiana-made vehicle. And I just thought how, when I was looking at older cars, and this was one of those places where I wanted to have the vocabulary of the actual. And so I was looking for actual cars that she might drive and that her foster father might have hidden away in his garage with great pride.
It's really a great name for a car model. My guest is Laird Hunt. His book is The Evening Road. And the last time we had you on the show was for your novel, Never Home. And I'm guessing that's out now in paperback. And I guess we need to talk about that a little bit, because part of the novel takes place right here in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Antioch College is part of the story. It's the story of a woman who goes into the Civil War disguised as a man. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working for about a decade now on stories that involve history and then the narratives of women. So it started actually with a book before Never Home called Kind One, and then I wrote Never Home as an exploration of this phenomenon. Again, something I didn't know very much about, that women in the hundreds disguised themselves as men during the Civil War and fought both for the North and the South. And it was just, you know, an extraordinary thing to get involved in terms of research, visiting battlefields, and reading the memoirs of some of the women who did this and studies of them. And while I was working on that project, I was spending a lot of time with my sister, Lorna Hunt, who lives in Yellow Springs. And I just, you know, fell in love with the town, the village, and also its history, which is really quite remarkable in and around Antioch College. And so it seems really natural that my fictional soldier, Ash Thompson, who is from Indiana, but to throw off any sort of suspicion, fights with a regiment out of Ohio, that she would encounter someone who was from Yellow Springs and actually visit the town of Yellow Springs after her experience in the war, and she spent some time there. I spent a lot of time walking around and looking for traces of the past, and I really feel like you can feel it and smell it and see it in the town itself and then in the surrounding countryside. So I really got a huge imaginative uplift from my encounter with Yellow Springs. And the book, at the center of Neverhome, there is an encounter on a road between my character Ash Thompson and then a young African-American woman who has also disguised herself as a man, and they find themselves in company for a while, and it becomes impossible for them to share the road. And so that notion carries over, of course, into the Evening Road, in which the road is being shared and not shared in different ways.
Oh.
And so these themes, starting with Kind One, moving to Neverhome, and then going to the Evening Road, all carry across, and I hope inform each other and speak to each other.
Well, I have not read the first one, but that second one, Neverhome, is just a fabulous story. And The Evening Road is the new one by Laird Hunt. And Laird, was it tough to write the ending?
You know, you're referring to The Evening Road?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always hard to write endings of the books. But somehow going this idea of the voice of Sally Gunner, this character who I really fell for, having her kind of take us out. And I wanted something that would both speak to the particularities of the novel, but also to the reader. And the last line of the book is really a question for the reader. How is this story going to end? It's kind of up to us, in a sense, how this story, this larger story of conflict and racial violence and the legacy of our fraught American history, how it plays out. It's up to us. And it seemed like a sort of positive, hopeful, forward-looking way. There were people who, my early readers, who read it, and some absolutely loved it, and some thought, oh, yeah, just cut that last line. And I'm so glad I didn't cut the last line. I think it gives it, again, a little bit of a lift at the end of a story, which isn't meant to falsely prettify things at all, but simply to allow for the possibility of hope. And I think that possibility is always there.
Yeah, I read that last line at about 2 a.m. last night, and I thought, what? What? It woke me up. I mean, it really, it really did.
I think, in my own life, I'm always looking for, whether I feel good about it or not, moments where I get a little bit woken up by something, whether it's a piece of music or a film or a book I'm reading. And even if there is perhaps a sense of, oh, I wish I had just a little bit more, give me more, there is something that's been switched on, even just for a minute, and I find those moments pretty rewarding.
Well, Laird, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Laird Hunt. His new novel is The Evening Road. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCumes.